Hi, this is C.K. Kubasik, the creator of The Booth at the End, and you are listening to The Sci-Fi Christian.
Welcome to The Sci-Fi Christian, bringing you theology at warp speed. I'm Matt Anderson.
And I am Ben DiBono, and we are back.
We're back, Ben, with the biggest episode in Sci-Fi Christian history.
Yeah, I don't know that I've ever been as excited for a Sci-Fi Christian episode as I am for this one right here.
Matt. I know.
This is huge.
So if this is your first time ever listening to The Sci-Fi Christian, welcome.
Yeah. I'm guessing we are going to have some new listeners because of the nature of this episode.
That's right.
So, yeah, welcome, guys. And we hope that you stick around and get a good feel for how the show is. And, yeah, check out our website and some of the great articles we have on there, too.
So, Ben, let's tell everybody, why is this such a big episode?
Well, Matt, you and I have been reviewing week after week the hit internet web series, The Booth at the End, starring Xander Berkeley.
Yes.
And along the way in our reviews, a very interesting person came across our work and thanked us for us.
Christopher C.K. Kubasik.
Yeah. And
he is the creator
and writer.
Writer of The Booth at the End.
Yeah, we kind of got in touch with him and we started sending some emails back and forth and eventually asked him to be on the show. And you know what? Tonight, he is going to be on The Sci-Fi Christian.
That's right. Now, the interview is already taking place as we record these words.
Yeah.
But it was such an awesome interview. I mean, we're about to do sci-fi news, but I can't wait until you guys can hear this 1 hour interview we did with CK.
Yeah, let's just tease a couple of the good things in there.
Do we have to? They're about to hear it.
Oh, let's tease it. Just,
okay.
Just to whet their appetites. You know, one of the things you might be wondering if you've seen the final episode of Booth at the End is there going to be a season two?
Well, we're going to find out.
We have the answer.
On this episode of The Sci-Fi Christian.
Yes. Now, you also know, if you're a longtime listener to The Sci-Fi Christian, that one of the things we like to do is really dig into the philosophy of genre fiction mm-hmm. and what are some of the different themes and the deep issues going on in fiction. Well, we asked the creator himself at the Booth at the End, what are some of the questions and themes he wants listeners to be digging into as they watch his material?
Mm-hmm.
So don't take our word for it this time. Get it directly from the source about what are some of the ideas and philosophy and even theology he's trying to explore in this series.
Yeah, and what I loved about CK's answers is that, you know, we had some things in mind that we thought maybe he would say, but he took it in a whole different direction. His answers were pretty awesome. So
definitely.
Yeah, I can't wait until you guys hear this interview.
If you're thinking like a really bad interview being where you ask a question and get a one word answer and then have a long, awkward pause, this was not that.
No.
We'd ask him a question. He'd go into so much detail on stuff and really dove into it. And it was just fantastic. We had an absolute blast talking to him. You guys are going to love this interview. It's great stuff.
So as we said, we know there's probably some people that are listening for the first time. So here's how we do it on the Sci-Fi Christian. We always have a main topic, but we start out with a little sci-fi news just to let you know what's happening in the world of sci-fi and genre fiction. And then we go to the main topic. And then what do we do, Ben?
Well, after our main topic, we will skip on over to a little listener feedback. You guys can always email us at feedback@thescifichristian.com or give us a call at
612-4121-SFC.
And if either of those don't work for you, there's also a contact form on the website you can use.
Yeah.
Or friend us on Facebook. Leave us a comment there. All sorts of ways you can get in contact with us.
You can follow us on Twitter.
Yes.
We're everywhere. So
we are everywhere.
Ben,
multimedia.
Do you know what time it is, Ben?
I believe, Matt, that it is time for Sci-Fi News.
It's time for Sci-Fi News. Well, Ben, where do we start?
Ooh, we got lots of superhero news.
As I was writing my notes, I thought it was superhero heavy, so I was counting on you, as the person that doesn't like superheroes as much as me, to get some non-superhero-y news.
Well, actually, I have a piece of superhero news you don't.
Let's hear it.
So, Green Lantern was a movie that neither of us liked.
No, we reviewed it and hated it.
Yeah, along with most everyone else out there. Not a very well-received movie.
No.
However, as we have known for a while now, it appears that Green Lantern 2 is going to go ahead.
Yes, we knew that. So what's the news of the week?
Well, the news is that the studio execs have come out and they said, we know how to make the sequel successful.
Ooh, yeah.
They've got the formula.
Oh, I think I did hear about this.
You want to know what it is?
I think that they want to make it darker.
Darker. Edgier and more emphasis on action.
Oh, interesting.
So basically what we're hearing here, Matt, is that the problem with Green Lantern is that it spent way too much time on character development and making the plot make sense. And if we just have a few more explosions, things will work.
Yeah, and the sad thing is a lot of people probably would prefer that, but, you know, we love the character development and the main storylines here.
And that's just not... this comment to me is so brain dead because...
Well, it's just the same as when Bryan Singer was comparing his X-Men movies to Matthew Vaughn's First Class.
Right.
As saying that because they made more money...
You mean Brett Ratner?
Yeah, who did I say?
Bryan Singer.
Yeah, so because his X-Men movies made more money, they're better movies, which is not true.
Exactly. But what doesn't make sense about this is that the whole darker and edgier thing is a reference to Batman Begins, mm-hmm. Dark Knight. We want to make that. We want that to be our model for superhero movies. But then you turn around and say a greater emphasis on action. Well, that tells me you just don't get it.
Mm-hmm.
Because Dark Knight isn't about action. It's about the characters. It's about the plot. It's about the themes and the questions the movie makes you ask. So it seems like they don't get what really works about the Dark Knight, and they're trying to do a Dark Knight model. And this is kind of going to be a common theme throughout Sci-Fi News tonight, Matt, mm-hmm. that studio execs, we praise them when they get it right, but this week has been a week for getting it wrong.
You know, in other DC news, the creators of Man of Steel, the next Superman movie, they've released the image, and we actually released it also on thescifichristian.com. I think Brendan is the one that posted that up there. And so, what did you think, Ben? The brand new image of the brand new Superman.
Well, I don't remember who said this, but the comment on our site that amused me the most was the person who said that he looks like Mitt Romney.
Yes.
That was hysterical.
His hair is the worst part about it.
As soon as I read that, I couldn't look at the picture and not see Mitt Romney standing there. So, yeah, he totally looks like Mitt Romney.
So, costume-wise, it doesn't look like anything too different.
I think it looks good.
But his hair, man. I mean, you know, I don't typically really care about people's hair, but it's not Superman hair. That's for sure.
You know what? I don't need Superman hair.
Yeah.
Nothing about the character really works for me, so I have no... Especially the hair. You're going to get hung up. People are going to get hung up on the hair.
You're saying Mitt Romney. Where do you think that comes from? It comes from the way his hair looks.
Well, it's slicked back, but is the complaint that you don't like the hair, is the complaint that it's not Superman hair? Because if the complaint is that it's not Superman hair... People need to get over that.
I guess I will just have to get over it. I mean, this is one image.
We're
over a year away from actually seeing the movie, so I'm not too worried about it at this point.
This has kind of been a week for taking individual images way out of context and judging entire movies off of them.
We'll have to talk about The Dark Knight.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, and the huge fan overreaction.
Yeah, but let's wait for that for Dark Knight news.
Absolutely.
So, also, I mean, we just have a ton of superhero movie news.
Yeah.
This is not necessarily news unless you're really excited about the sequel to a movie that hasn't come out yet. But Amazing Spider-Man 2 is going to be released on May 2nd, 2014. So mark your calendars, Ben.
Okay, Matt, I've got a question for you.
Yeah.
This seems to be becoming a trend recently.
Very recently. And yes, I don't understand what's happening.
I mean, we had Captain America 2 get greenlit before Captain America. And Captain America is so-so. You know, it doesn't
Then we liked it.
We thought it was... you gave it 3.5 stars out of 5. I gave it 3 out of 5. So we thought it was so-so.
Okay.
I mean, 3, 3.5, that's a so-so rating. We didn't think it was bad. We didn't think it was great. It didn't, to me, feel like... I don't necessarily want to see a sequel to it.
Oh, I definitely want to see a sequel.
Really?
Yeah, definitely.
Why?
I love Captain America.
Okay, but what about this take on Captain America?
I liked it. Actually, I'd be glad to see it again. When I saw Thor, I liked it less after it. I like Captain America more since I've seen
really?
It.
Yeah. I think I've gone in the other direction a little bit.
You like Thor more?
No. I probably have liked Thor a little bit more.
Okay.
And I think I'm liking Captain America less I think about it.
So I think it is odd that... And maybe the movie studios just want to book those dates, but I don't know why we're getting the dates for the sequel release when the first one's not even out yet.
Yeah, so kind of a strange pattern, and I don't like it because it seems to me to say that the studios aren't really interested in seeing if the movies are actually decent. They're saying, we're going to make money off of these movies, so we're just going to go ahead and plan the sequel, and we don't care if the first one turns out good or not.
Yeah.
And if it turns out bad, we'll just say it needs to be darker, edgier, and have more action.
Ben, what do you think about Morpheus in The Matrix?
Oh, I like Morpheus.
What would you think about Morpheus in Superman.
I think that would be a great choice.
That is a great choice.
Now, I don't know a whole lot about the role because I'm not a huge Superman fan, so okay. Tell me a little bit about Perry White.
Perry White, he's kind of the J. Jonah Jameson of
he's
Superman.
A newspaper editor.
Newspaper editor, kind of a little gruff, but I think he's more obviously more nice than J. Jonah Jameson in Spider-Man.
Yeah, because everything's kind of wimpy in the Superman universe.
Ooh.
little shot there.
Not cool. So just kind of picture like kind of a gruff boss, but still kindly.
Yeah, okay. I mean, I think that'll be a good role for Lawrence Fishburne. He's a great actor. And so you're only going to make the film stronger by adding him. You know, for all of the negative press that's been circulating this film with script troubles and mm-hmm. everything, they've done a good job assembling the cast.
Oh, yeah. Cast is good.
Yeah. Amy Adams is a great actress who's going to be playing Lois Lane. Mm-hmm. Lawrence Fishburne's great. Henry Cavill, we don't know a whole lot about, but I think he...
What do you think about Kevin Costner and Sally Field?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think we're going to have a good, well-acted movie at the very least.
Very good. Ben, what do you got next?
Well, Matt, we have a couple of... kind of getting back to the whole studio execs who do dumb things theme. You had news about Eureka, and I have news about Walking Dead. How about you give us Eureka first?
Yeah, so Eureka, I guess their fifth season, when I read this article, it sounded like some of the episodes have already been completed, or are they just...
Yeah, I think so.
So, but it's not... season 5 of Eureka isn't coming out until next year.
Yeah, because Sci-Fi does, like, weird things with their seasons.
Right, and Sci-Fi has promised a sixth season, but wait... They've actually canceled that promise, and we've now found out that season 5 will be the last season of the canceled Eureka.
Well, yeah, they're too busy developing alphas, man.
Yes.
You know, Shakespearean writing on that show.
Yeah, I never watched it again after that first episode, did you?
I haven't because I haven't released any more on Hulu.
Oh.
I'd check out the second episode if they released it on Hulu, but nothing in the first episode really intrigued me very much. It was not a very good show.
No, I didn't like it at all. So... Ben, you've never watched Eureka. I've watched only the pilot. I do own the first season. I've just not had time to check it out.
No, it's a show that's on my radar screen at some point, but like you, I just haven't gotten around to it yet.
I think it has some promise. So I'm actually sad to hear that it's got canceled because I looked forward to many episodes of future viewing.
Yeah, hopefully the creators have a chance to actually give the show some resolution.
They do. That is something I read about it, is that they do have time now to wrap it up. I think they also had in mind a holiday special for this? Do you know about that? Similar to what they do with Doctor Who.
The spinoff show, Doctor Who.
Yeah, so Eureka is going to have some sort of holiday movie. I don't know if that must happen before this fifth and final season.
Yeah, but here's what kind of sucks about this, because if the creators were thinking, we've got two more seasons to wrap up our storylines and do everything, so even though they have time to go back now and write stuff and finish things up in 1 year, they're basically cutting the storyline time down in half from what they thought they had to work with,
exactly.
Which is going to impact the quality, guaranteed.
Yeah, definitely. So you'd said you had something about Walking Dead?
Okay, so last episode, we reported the big news that Frank Darabont had walked off the set of Walking Dead, was no longer the showrunner. Well, that might not have been quite as accurate.
Really?
Initially
I had not heard
that. Have you read this today? This is breaking news today.
All right, let's hear it.
So the Hollywood Reporter came out with an exclusive piece where they have talked to anonymous cast and crew members from Walking Dead who said, oh, no, Frank Darabont did not walk off the set. Frank Darabont was fired.
Bum, bum, bum.
By AMC.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
Because they did not like the fact that he... was upset about the budget being cut. Mm-hmm. They didn't like the fact that he was taking too much of a cinematic approach rather than just churning out episodes in the way they wanted.
Oh, no, that's not good.
There was a lot of conflict between them. And so now, what the other thing the show said is that the cast feels terrorized by the show, or by AMC and how they're handling this. The cast is feeling like they're very demoralized by this decision. And things are not going well on the set of season two of Walking Dead.
So you've been watching season one.
I have finished season one.
How did you like it?
It's really good. It has some departures from the graphic novels. I don't know if they were the best choice or not.
Okay.
But I really, really liked it. It's extremely well done.
So cinematic, can you see that quality in it?
Yeah.
And you'll be sad to see it go?
Absolutely.
Yeah, of course.
Here's the interesting thing about this, Matt. And this goes a little bit outside genre fiction, but it's worth mentioning.
Okay.
AMC has a few hit shows. They have
Mad Men,
Breaking Bad, and Walking Dead. These are kind of their three big shows. And within the last few months, AMC executives have gotten into heated public fights with all three showrunners.
But, okay, so I think I might know where you're going with this, but you know that they just poured tons of money into Mad Men.
Yeah.
And then took away money from Breaking Bad and Walking Dead.
Right. But before things got resolved with Mad Men, that was a pretty public, mm-hmm. drawn-out argument. Mm-hmm. So what does it say about a network that's trying to establish themselves as kind of a competitor to HBO, FX, some of those cable channels, and has been doing a good job, has been critically acclaimed, and then they basically get into wars with three of their showrunners on their three biggest shows?
Yeah, I mean, that's not a good sign for their future.
And not to mention that Walking Dead, they're taking money away from it, and it has more viewers than either of the other two.
Oh, really? I thought Mad Men was sort of their premier show.
That's the one that's gotten the most acclaim, mm-hmm. but Mad Men gets like something around 4 million viewers an episode, and Walking Dead was having between 5 and 6 in season one. It's their biggest hit ever, and they're taking away from it.
Yeah, and knowing what Walking Dead's about, I've read the graphic novel, not seen the show yet. You know, it's obviously going to require a lot of money to do just the makeup alone.
Yeah. So, you know, but they did a good job. I mean, the money that they were spending on the show helped it be high quality. It doesn't make any sense what AMC is doing. If they want to become a legitimate competitor to HBO, they need to knock it off, quit alienating their showrunners, quit alienating their fans, produce high-quality entertainment, really realize that's going to cost them money, just suck it up and deal with it. Otherwise, just go back to showing old movies and fade into your irrelevancy, because that's where you're going if you alienate your showrunners.
Exactly. You know, Ben, just to turn the tide a little bit, I've got a story that is actually, it happened years ago, but it's just now starting to get out from what I understand.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a NASA intern.
Oh, yeah, this is great.
Who stole $21 million worth of lunar rocks. And uh-huh. Ben, the reason he stole these lunar rocks is because, this is a quote, well, I don't know if this is a quote, but this is the quote I'm going to say. He wanted to have sex on the moon.
Why not? Why not?
So, Ben, $21 million worth of lunar rocks? Is that worth it?
Absolutely. No, this is there's a book written on this called Sex on the Moon.
Okay, so
written by the guy who wrote the book The Accidental Millionaires, which became the film
Social Network. Yeah. So when did this book come out? Because I just read this news this week, and it sounded like it was just now being released to the public.
I think it's a more recent book, but I'm not 100% sure.
Yeah,
I might have to read it.
This is very interesting.
Hysterical.
Yeah.
Favorite heist ever, and it needs to be a movie. This needs to be a movie.
Okay, Ben.
Anything else, Matt, before we get to Dark Knight Rises?
Yeah, we've got two more things here. We just talked about sci-fi, which is owned by Universal. They also own NBC, and they've ordered a new movie, a script to be wrote, about a modern-day Frankenstein.
Sounds good. I'm glad we're getting more genre
fiction.
This
is coming
TV.
From the executive producers of House. So if you like House, you might like this new Frankenstein show.
I've never seen House, but I'm intrigued.
And Ben, you told me before we started that you had some World War Z news.
Well, yeah. You know, it had previously been reported that Matthew Fox of Lost fame had been cast in World War Z. And then it was reported that he was not going to be in it after all. But now a set photo has leaked of Matthew Fox on the set of World War Z.
Very interesting. I just read today World War Z's release date. Speaking of release dates, it is December 21st, 2012, which, as we all know, is the end of the Mayan calendar and
End of the world. That'll be it.
Oh, speaking of end of the world, I do have one last piece of movie news, and it has nothing to do with the end of the world.
Okay.
But we've been talking.
That's a bad segue.
We've been tracking these Snow White movies from these different studios. Well, guess what? Disney's got one too.
Oh, my gosh.
Only this one is going to be set in China, and it actually has a pretty sweet title. It's called The Order of the Seven.
So if you have always dreamed of three Snow White movies coming out at the same time,
this is your dream come true.
You are in heaven.
There's actually a song by Disney about dreams come true. How does that go?
A dream is a wish. Yes. Your heart
is that in Snow White?
No, probably. I think that's Cinderella.
Or Sleeping Beauty.
I don't know.
Me either.
Those movies play constantly at my house because I have a 2-year-old daughter, so I should know, but I do not. I think it's Cinderella.
Wow.
Pretty sure.
All right, Ben. Well, I think it's time for us to head off to
the Batmobile.
Let's go.
To the Batmobile. Let's go.
Well, Ben, lots of interesting news.
Yeah, and I know you have it all stacked up there, so why don't you just go ahead and run through it, and I will react as needed.
Okay, first of all, we have a couple set leaks this week.
Set leaks? You mean photo leaks?
Yes.
Okay.
First one is that Marion Cotillard, or however you say her last name, we're still not sure on that point, who has been previously reported to be playing a Wayne Enterprises executive. You remember that?
Yes.
She's going to play a board member or something like that.
Yeah, wait. Are you about to spoil a plot point, potentially?
Possibly.
Okay, I am going to take off my headphones, as all of the audience knows.
So you're not going to be reacting to this.
So, yeah, I mean, I'm putting my foot down on being spoiled on The Dark Knight.
Okay.
So I will be setting these down. Okay, continue.
All right, so it would appear this isn't going to work. You're still the same robot as me.
Yeah, you're right. This doesn't work at all.
You're just going to have to suck it up and deal with it. This is a rumor.
I'm plugging my ears. Okay. Go ahead.
That she was in garb that would not seem to be fitting for a Wayne Enterprises board member, but would seem to be very fitting for Talia al Ghul. So it would seem that she's...
Did you have to say that louder?
Yep. I did that just for you, Matt. It would seem that she might be playing Talia after all, as was previously reported. All right, Matt, we're ready for you to come back.
Okay, I'm back.
Okay. It was also reported that Ben Roethlisberger and the Pittsburgh Steelers are going to be having a cameo in Dark Knight Rises.
Well, remember I tried to get you to go with me to Pittsburgh so we could be extras in this scene.
Yeah, and there was a lot of videos and footage leaked from Heinz Field this week, which is the home of the Pittsburgh Steelers, of explosions.
Mm-hmm.
And Bane coming out, preparing to execute someone. We don't know who.
Yeah, man. I wish I didn't know all this stuff. I read too much of the sci-fi news.
Here's the really wild thing.
What?
One of the photos showed multiple tumblers. You know the Batmobile, the tumbler?
Yep.
There are multiple tumblers at Heinz Field while this is being filmed. Now, that could mean that they just have multiple ones for different shots.
Yeah.
Or it could mean that Bane is in control of several Batmobiles.
Or it could mean, as we've both been wishing, that Robin will appear in this movie.
How could it mean that?
Because he's driving one of the Batmobiles.
No. These are not painted in Batmobile colors. They're painted in kind of the tan camouflage. So they seem to be under Bane's control, not under Batman's control.
Yeah, we have to talk about what we're going to cover, because I don't want to talk about all this stuff. I want to be as surprised as possible next June.
It's good stuff, man. It's good stuff.
So does this not ruin the movie for you
at all? No, absolutely not. Because, again, the movie isn't about whether or not I know that Bane has a tumbler.
Yeah.
The movie is about the themes and the characters and the questions that it's going to make me ask. Dark Knight, I know everything about that movie now, and it's an incredible experience to watch it every time. There's nothing... I don't care.
Okay.
I don't want to know everything.
I guess I probably, between the two of us, I do like the surprise element of a show more than you.
I have a very interesting news story on that for next week.
Okay.
That I'm going to pull out that may make you question your position on this point, Matt.
All right. I will look forward to next week.
Little tease for next week.
So let's talk about some big photo release news, because this is not a spoiler, because the studio itself has released photos of Anne Hathaway in her Catwoman costume.
Yes, riding the Batpod.
Yes, that motorcycle.
Yeah.
So why would they release that photo?
Because it's not a spoiler. She's on a motorcycle.
But it's on Batman's motorcycle. So either one, they're working together, or two, she stole it.
Okay, so you don't know.
I don't know, but I know I have a 50% chance of being right.
It doesn't matter. Is that going to ruin the movie for you because you know that she rides the Batpod at some point?
So let us go now then to your reaction to her costume, because this is where the uproar is coming from.
Okay, so a lot of fans, in my opinion, have really overreacted about this, including on our side. I'm going to call out some of our own fans here. Not by name, but in general, the reaction has been pretty negative. Oh, that's a terrible costume. It looks awful. Okay, a few things here. Number one, you're seeing one shot, out of context, not in motion. You have no idea how this costume is going to look on screen.
Mm-hmm.
Not to mention that the shot, it really obscures her pretty a lot because she's hunched over on the bike.
Yeah.
You don't see her costume very well. The second thing is that if you seriously are watching these movies because of how a costume looks, then you don't understand Christopher Nolan's take on Batman.
What about how their hair looks?
Who cares?
I'm just kidding.
It's about the storytelling. It's about the characters. And Christopher Nolan is going to do an amazing job, even if the costume does look bad, and I don't think it's going to in motion.
Mm-hmm.
But even if it does, who cares? He's going to tell an amazing story. And I think that the fans really need to calm down and take a step back on this one. I think they're wrong. And I think that people who are freaking out that this Nolan's doing a terrible job, he's making a terrible decision here, really need to have a bit more faith in him and shut up a bit.
This is what I think is happening, Ben. So you don't read the comics as much, maybe sometimes here and there.
Yeah.
I think the people that are really getting upset are the people that are invested in the Catwoman character and want to see a costume that lines up with what they are familiar with.
Okay, but let me take you back a few years ago to Joker. Joker's going to be wearing white makeup. He's not going to have a white face.
No, I mean, there are versions of Joker that have worn white makeup.
No, Joker in the comics, canonically, does not wear makeup. His face is white. So Christopher Nolan takes that costume and he does it in a non-comic book way.
Well, I mean, Jack Nicholson.
No, his face turns white in that movie.
No, it's makeup. He puts makeup on.
Okay.
Go back and watch it.
In any case, it certainly was a different take on the Joker costume than we've seen before. Ra's al Ghul is a very different take than what we've seen before. Scarecrow is a different take than what we've seen before. Everything Christopher Nolan is doing, he's not doing it the comic book way.
Mm-hmm.
If you love the comic book way, that's great. But recognize that that's not what this world is.
Hmm.
Feel free to go rewatch Batman Returns, you know, if you want that. This isn't that, which is a good movie, I think.
You think Batman Returns is...
I like that one, okay. Yeah. That's probably my favorite of the original four.
Interesting. What else you got for Dark Knight News?
I think that's about it. What do you think about the costume, Matt?
I feel very similar to you. I haven't seen enough to really make a decision, and I don't feel that strongly about it.
What do you think of the reaction out there? People really acting like Christopher Nolan's jumped the shark, that he's really taking things down.
That's too much.
Yeah. It's about the story and about the characters, ultimately. Even if the costume does look stupid, it won't ruin the movie for me.
I agree.
All right, Matt, I think it's time for the main event.
Yes. No, we've already been hyping it up. Let's just do it, Ben. Let's play that music and go straight to our interview with CK.
Kubasik.
All right, Sci-Fi Christian fans, we're here today with Christopher CK Kubasik. CK, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me on. How are you guys doing today?
We're doing great. How are you?
Good. I'm very good.
So you've already had some interviews going on today?
Yeah, I spoke with Mindy Peterman from the Mortimer Report, which is an online site about media stuff.
Nice.
Yeah.
So you've been doing a lot of interviews lately with Booth at the End starting to take off and everything?
Well, let me clarify. Actually, it's called the Morton Report. No. One of the things I was talking about with Mindy was that we've had a lovely article, an interview with Xander in an online blog from the Wall Street Journal, and then last week we were the TV pick of the week for People Magazine, which is amazing.
Yeah, wow. Nice. Yeah, that's awesome.
And then not much else. And I had a sort of like what is going on, because obviously I love the show because it's my baby and I'm very protective of it, perhaps more so than I should be. And then I also know that people seem to be really responding to it. You know, some people hate it and hate it very much, and some people love it and love it very much.
Yeah.
And then we've got the people in the middle who are sort of like, I don't quite understand this, but I can't stop watching it.
At least they're watching, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Right. So I think we're doing well. And then it dawned on me that no one's in charge of actually paying attention to internet content.
Oh, nice.
Like, the people whose job it is to watch movies and to talk about movies or gossip about celebrities or to talk about what's happening, you know, right now with all the TV pilots being pitched to the press. But nobody's job is to actually pay attention to what's on Hulu that's never been seen anywhere else.
Mm.
We don't have anyone really looking at our show except for the people who are hearing about it online. And the fact that the word is getting out, I think, again, speaks testament to the kind of appeal the show seems to have for people.
Yeah, exactly. Are you the one that's personally taking care of some of the social media stuff, or do you have somebody else doing that?
No, I am not.
Okay.
And anything I'm doing is either screwing up their plans by accident or my enthusiasm, I hope, will shine through and I'm seen as a man who just simply cares too much. It's Vugaroo, which is a company that Michael Eisner has partnered with and is in charge of building a slate of internet content, are responsible for the studio that produced the show at the end. It was started actually by a company called... Tornante, which is another one of Michael Eisner's companies. They are now in charge of TV and film development, and Vugaroo is now in charge of online development. They have hired companies to handle the press, the social media aspects. Attention Span Media is one of the companies handling promotion for the booth.
Nice.
I'm just a man who said, I think this is what you do these days.
Yeah.
You connect with people. I got a Twitter account 4 weeks ago now.
I'm following you.
Booth. which has been a blast, because I have to tell you, you know, my manager reminded me of this just a couple days ago, about a week ago, when the response has been sort of building. He said, remember, CK, in 2007, when you were first creating the show, you said the internet is for arguments, and you wanted a show that would create arguments. You've won! So,
absolutely. I mean, one of the great things about the show is the way it draws you into the moral dilemmas that are taking place, and you really get involved with the characters' choices that they're making.
Well, yeah, and I am loving being able to watch the different kinds of discussions, if not arguments, but also people really sharing things that's taking place. There's discussions about the moral elements. There's discussions about the just the formal structural aspects of how the story is told, which is, you know, unique and something I did on purpose. And people who go, wow, this is really cool, I haven't seen this before, are like, you made it wrong. And there's fights about that.
Wow.
There's so many ways for people to enter the discussion. And that's a little bit by design. And I'm really happy it's having the response it has. I have to say, for example, the blog post that, was it Dave?
Yeah, Dave.
Yeah, wrote about using the booth as an entry point to have a blog post about prayer, which is like one of the smartest jumps that could have been made. I was interviewed by somebody yesterday. I brought it up, just this idea that, you know, the man is sort of this guy who poses this opportunity for intercession. And okay, so now what? And it puts it in a new light, obviously. But that desire where we just want God to fix things.
Yeah.
Just one kind of praying, but isn't necessarily what prayer is.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what really intrigued us about the show, because as I'm sure you can tell by our title, Sci-Fi Christian, we kind of look for things like that that can kind of be jumping off points into some of those theological discussions. And I got to tell you, the show really has piqued our interest in that way.
Yeah, absolutely.
The way Dave went, and also in the other direction of thinking, is the man evil? You know,
right.
And what does it mean when he's giving these tasks, some of which are good and some of which are pretty sadistic? And there's just a lot of different directions you can go with it in terms of picking it apart and digging down into the philosophy of what's going on in the show.
Yeah.
You know, before we get into the booth at the end, though, we talked about a little bit about this off air, but can you tell us just kind of how you got into the business?
The business or this particular end of the business?
Well, maybe both.
All right. So I was one of those kids who wrote all the time, you know, writing picture books and stapling them down the center so I could make little books for myself when I was a child. I played role-playing games when I was a kid, like Dungeons and Dragons and things like that. So I always loved storytelling, loved movies, would run home from school to watch the 4:30 movie in New York, which was always like monster movies or war movies, and just loved this stuff. In 10th grade, I think the real turning point came for me when I was in a class with a man named Dr. DeGennaro, Michael DeGennaro. He introduced me to Nathaniel Hawthorne and Shakespeare and Edward Albee, the Greek tragedies. And it was suddenly, I realized how cool stories could be because they dealt with the grown-up things that weren't on TV, and a whole new world of like, oh, stories can do this stuff. And that's when I began doing theater. Went to Northwestern University to study theater and film. When I got out, I started doing freelance writing for those role-playing games. Ended up getting novels that I wrote, science fiction fantasy novels. That led to a screenplay deal with New Line Cinema. And then there's been other writing, and also I've been acting as well over the years. I don't do that anymore, but that was part of my life as well.
Yeah, you mentioned the novels that you've written, and we were looking you up a little bit online, stalking you on IMDb and whatnot, and we came across your novels, and we're both big readers. I'm just curious if that's something you're interested in going back to at some point, or do you have any more plans
really
on that?
Novels are, just have so many words.
Yeah.
Just so many words. And I think it was Robert Towne talking about Robert Bolt's screenplay for, I think it was Bolt's screenplay for Lawrence of Arabia, and just the sparseness of it. And I've really fallen in love with trying to communicate as much as I can with as little as I can. I've been reading a lot of, I tend to read older things in general. I don't read a lot of contemporary fiction, honestly.
Mm-hmm.
when I read like Seamus Heaney's translation of Beowulf or the Fitzgerald translation of the Iliad or the Odyssey. And there's something about poetry or even Shakespeare where you're just cramming in the images and you're getting it out and then you're moving on.
Yep.
That I really love. And dramatic narrative, whether it's plays or film or television or now the internet, is all about compactness. And I love finding out, you know, when I talked about the booth for a while, one of my analogies is I tried to figure out how big a story I could put in the smallest real estate, a diner booth. And that kind of compactness really I find compelling. And so this is the medium and the playground more that I want to be playing with rather than novels.
Yeah, so this isn't your first series. Can you tell us about the first series you worked on?
Well, Stranger Adventures for the Internet was a terrific idea. It was a mix of storytelling and puzzle where you would get you would sign up for this show, and every week a new character would be on a treasure hunt of some kind, whether they were looking for a lost Shakespeare manuscript or a treasure their dad had left behind for them of old coins or whatever. And they'd be running around for a week looking for clues, and then they were so busy running around they didn't have time to put the clues together, so they would send you video messages or emails, and then you would assemble the clues. And whoever helped the character get to the treasure by noon on Saturday would split the treasure with the character. A very smart idea. We never got the financing together on it, but that was the show I was the head writer on. Okay. And then I went from there. What happened with that was I cut us three very clever trailers that I submitted to the Emmy Academy. So we ended up getting three nominations for broadband content the first year they were giving out nominations for broadband content, which was great because we were up against Yahoo and AOL and Time Warner. We were this scrappy little startup, and we were getting these nominations, which is fantastic. And then once that company folded, I went and sold the show to ABC, had a startup called Stage 9 on their lot, which was supposed to be developing online content. Sold the show to them called Weirdness.com. That company collapsed before that show could get made, and I tried to pitch them the booth, and they didn't buy it, which was lucky. And then I still had the booth, and I pitched it around town for about a year until I pitched it at Tornante, and Steve Cohn and Joshua Rhimes ended up buying it. And strangely, I had first met Josh when he was one of my writers at Stranger Adventures the year before.
So when did this idea for the booth first come to you?
Well, it was around the time, it was in 2007, I was, again, pitching, you know, working on a show for ABC, for their online division, and I really wanted to try to figure out how to build something bigger and more ambitious in scope. At the time, the whole mantra was, especially at Hollywood, and it very much still is that they have no attention span online, they only want short things. And I said, you're wrong, time and time again. I said, if you could put Gossip Girl on an iPhone, it would make everybody happy. But their attitude, I think it's a little bit of crankiness. It's they're not watching the content the way we want them to watch it, so we're going to demean them and say they have no attention span, which is simply not true. And I said, no, I want to build something really big. I want to build something that has scope. I want to build something that's a draw. One of my mottos is that if everybody in town is developing giant robot movies, you build a movie about a small mouse because then you'll stand out. And so everyone was doing short and comic. And I said, I'm going to do big and I'm going to do drama. And that was part of my design spec. I wanted a big story. You should know that I tend to think of things architecturally or in terms of design. Writing is simply a tool of the design process for me. So I wrote down more at the top of the page when I began working. I wrote the words, no slumming, because internet content, especially at that time, a few years ago, was sort of like what I call the tiny TV. People would make things that were like TV shows or movies, but weren't compelling on their own. They were just sort of, I liked this, so I'm going to do my version of it, but smaller. And I wanted to make something that was going to, again, stand out and also have a very high bar. Whether or not we succeeded or not, I don't know. Everyone has to decide that on their own. But my agenda was to make something ambitious that would have to stand out and be noticed because it was different than the other things being made.
Yeah, I think you absolutely succeeded at that, and definitely in terms of the way a lot of other studios and shows are using web content, it's just so intriguing to me that there's a, you know, you're able to develop a series that has good episodes and has a real story arc, and you're really drawn into these characters in the way you would in a normal TV show, and there just isn't a whole lot of that out there.
Well, I credit the guys at Tornante originally, and then Vougaroo, for picking up the torch and getting it out the door. But it was Steve Cohen and Josh Rhimes. I pitched to them. I finished pitching. We were in a conference room, and I finished pitching. And I think I was standing at the time, because I usually end standing in my pitches. There's a very P.T. Barnum quality to me. And Steve looks up at me and says, "That's really well thought out." I said, "Yeah, I was just telling my manager, I don't think I should be pitching things unless they're well thought out." And he went, "Yeah, that's usually not what we get." And I really wanted to set the bar high. And they were the ones who had faith in it. I mean, they liked it. I then sent them the first four scenes of the show. I went home and wrote. Actually, there's a story about that. But I wrote the first four scenes and sent them to them so they could see how it would look on the page and get a feel for how it was going to work. And then several weeks passed, and I said to my manager, Joel Newton, I said, "Okay, I'm going to go home. I'm going to write the first 60 pages of this thing. And that way, they'll either hate it and we can move on, or love it and we'll be forcing them to make a deal." And I wrote the first 60 pages, and they loved them. And more weeks went by until I finally had to have a meeting with Michael Eisner, because Michael wanted to make sure I wasn't going to write, and especially the beginning beats of the story, he wanted to make sure I wasn't making some sort of nihilistic, immoral jerk off of the audience.
Yeah.
That there was actually a point to it. And I had to sit down with him and say, "I believe I am, this is a very moral show. I believe I am writing in the New England supernatural tradition that began with Nathaniel Hawthorne and Washington Irving. And, you know, Stephen King is a modern practitioner of that today. And that I'm shining a light on immoral things so that we see clearly the choices we make as people to be responsible about who we are and how we conduct ourselves each day."
Yeah, I think the show is extremely moral, and I think to me that point has certainly come across, and I think you've done a fantastic job with it. One of the things you mentioned was that you approach shows architecturally and kind of looking at the structure of things, and we had a couple of our fans write in and wanted to know from you.
That's awesome that fans are writing into you about this. I am so happy. You just made me the happiest guy on the planet. Okay, cool. Go ahead.
Yeah, we've got a lot of people are pretty excited about it. And one of the big things that has come up in the questions we've gotten in is the interconnectedness in the show.
Sure.
Where slowly but surely we've started to see different ties between the characters and their storylines. And is that something you had planned from the beginning, or did it grow more out of the story and process and even the shooting process as the series went on?
When we shot the show, that was pretty much the script. I'm a big believer in, you know, I'm not a stickler for the dialogue itself. I'm not precious about the dialogue. There are story beats that have to be conveyed, but I know that actors, certain words or phrasings will sound better or worse in a certain actor's mouth. So if an actor says, "Well, can I say it this way?" and it gets the story beat across, that's fine. But the stories themselves were written as we arrived on the set. We made some cuts along the way. We expanded a couple beats along the way. But the plots were done by the time we arrived on set. I would offer that the interconnected part was kind of late in the design process, the blueprint phase, if you will. I knew I wanted to build a show after what happened at Stage 9, when they wanted something TV worthy with a big budget to sustain 5.1 Dolby and look great, but also have cost nothing because it was for the internet. Mm-hmm. I said, "Okay, I never want to have a show of mine collapse because suddenly we realize we can't afford it after all again." So I wanted something very simple. And I realized that the cinematic language we've built over the last 100 years is a lot where the money comes from, because you spend a lot of time getting coverage of the hand picking up the mug or whatever. It just takes time to shoot something that way. So I said, I'm going to just crumple up the language of cinematic storytelling, and I'm going to throw it away. And then what am I left with? Well, I've got a browser window that's actually smaller than a 1950s television. This was before the iPad came out. The iPad was going to come out about a year and a half later. And I said, okay, so let's start thinking in terms of 1950s television. That hung on actors' faces and the dialogue. And I know certain things I can draw from my theatrical training, both as a guy who used to write plays and as an actor who's directed and acted in plays. What can I pull together to tell compelling stories? And then I remembered also that I've been a storyteller. I volunteered at children's museums and elementary schools here in L.A. to read folk tales, fairy tales, things like that. So I know I trust my instincts as a storyteller. So I began cobbling together techniques that would, I think, build a new kind of storytelling for this genre. Other design elements were the fact that, and this is what I find fascinating, and other people really have not, as far as I can tell, been thinking this through. A lot of people look at the internet and are very excited about the lowering of the cost of the production. We focus a lot on the fact that we can use a Canon 5D or whatever. But what people aren't paying attention to is that normally when we go to a play or a movie, or even TV is still shot this way, it's designed to be watched socially as a group. There's an audience of people that we're responding collectively with. Well, we use the internet alone. And I thought, what does that do to storytelling? Even if we're using a camera, what kind of stories, what kind of storytelling makes the most sense for an activity which by definition is more like reading a book in terms of its solitary nature? What kinds of stories and how to tell them should I be focusing on if I'm making something designed specifically for the internet? So those were some of the things I was thinking about as I was thinking about the architectural design elements before I even got around to a guy in a booth.
You know, you talked about making it for the internet. What made you originally want to get into web series? And is that something that it's always appealed to you?
No, I'm in the ghetto right now. Let's face it. I am in a medium where we lucked out with People Magazine giving us pick of the week last week for TV, right? We were People Magazine's TV pick of the week. Now, that's strange because we're on the internet.
Yeah.
But I think we're in a weird phase where internet and TV is blurring very fast.
Yeah, definitely.
Thank God. But again, this is 2007. I got hired on Stranger Adventures in 2006. I hadn't thought at all about the internet. The shows I was loving were The Shield, Battlestar Galactica, 6 Feet Under, Rescue Me. Like, to me, it was all long-form cable. That's what I love. Serialized long-form cable drama is the thing that turns me on the most.
Yeah, we love
I got
stuff.
Hired on the show, Stranger Adventures, because I needed a job, and you take jobs. And I was fascinated that there was this whole new arena growing up. And I would, because I have a sense of history, and I say that with a tinge of arrogance, I suppose, because I get a sense a lot of people don't have a sense of history. I'm able to look back and think, people are saying like, wow, Netflix is building new content. That's crazy. And I'm thinking, well, you do remember that once upon a time, HBO only showed movies. Right,
that's
guys?
Lovely. That's tough to imagine these days.
But nobody does imagine it. And the point is that once upon a time, there was no movies. And it was just two guys with a motion picture camera and a tent sitting, camped out by a riverside in California, trying to figure out how to make a movie. And the distribution system was a tent with a sheet hanging inside, right?
Yeah.
Once upon a time, there was no TV. And it was these little boxes, and like one out of 100,000 Americans had one. And neighbors would gather around the block to watch the one show that was on a Thursday night because it was a novelty. And then cable comes along, or even before that, Fox Television. Fox was the fourth network, and once upon a time, and I bet you guys didn't even live through this probably, but they were considered a joke. David Letterman made a joke one year about, and he said, and Fox will be at the up front too in their tent, because they weren't a real network. ABC, NBC, CBS were real networks. Fox was nothing. And then HBO only shows movies, and nobody remembers this. But in the early years of HBO, there were these things called the ACE Awards, which HBO sponsored to give awards to content made specifically on and for cable, because the Emmys would not touch cable at all. It wasn't considered good enough to give awards. They would only give awards. The Emmys would only give awards to the network shows. So there's been this tradition of, well, there's a new field that is found, and you have to sow it yourself and plant the seeds yourself. But what's fascinating to me, and this gets to the answer to your question, why I'm digging in so deep into this, is because when Fox had to make their name, let's go back further. When TV was being built, the show that really broke out TV was Howdy Doody. Because most TV shows up to that point were just radio programs with a camera pointed at it. But with Howdy Doody, if you didn't see it and only heard it, you didn't get the joke of the fact that the doll was talking, that it was a marionette. And then I Love Lucy comes along and does this amazing routines that are physical. And again, if you don't have a TV and you're not watching it, you're not getting the show. Because so much of that show depends on Lucille Ball's physicality and the humor being not verbally driven, but physically driven. And then with Fox, they develop The Simpsons and The X-Files. And these are shows that would have died in development at ABC or NBC or CBS at the time, but Fox had nothing to lose. So they put on these two really weird shows that, even if they'd made it through development at the three major networks, would have died within 3 weeks. They would have been yanked off the schedule because nobody would have known what to make of them. But on Fox, there are these two weird shows that you can't see anywhere else. And so people start showing up to Fox. And that's how they build their network, because they built shows that could not have aired anyone else. And then HBO makes The Sopranos. And FX makes The Shield, right? So all these are traditions of making the thing that nobody else could have made elsewhere. And what I find compelling, I have this little accidental mission statement I made a couple weeks ago that I was writing an email to somebody. And the first thing is, I want to make stories people don't see coming down the road. And the internet is a place right now, like HBO a decade ago, like TV 50 years ago when Rod Serling was making television, where you can play and do things that nobody knows what's right or wrong yet. And you can make really cool things because of that. So to me, it's an amazing space to play in. My friend Eric Heiserer, he wrote the screenplay for Final Destination 5 and The Thing prequel coming out this summer. He's written this amazing short story, and we were talking about it. I said, what are you going to do with it? He said, I don't know. It's kind of weird. I said, you know, in terms of the material, it'd be great as an internet series. It'd be perfect, actually. And he said, all right, it's yours. You know, you are now the godfather of this material. Go get it produced. And so I'm collecting material that I don't see how it would work anywhere else, but I know we could make really great content because the internet space is a place for playing right now. And I truly believe if you play hard and set high bars, you'll make good stuff out of that.
Yeah, that's cool. And that kind of leads into the next question I was going to ask you, which is, what's next for you? Are you, without giving any spoilers away for tomorrow's episode, is there a chance of a season 2 for Booth at the End? Are you going to be pursuing the internet series? I know you have a short film called In the Eyes that's coming out soon. What are you working on?
Sure. Well, for the Booth, tomorrow is the posting of the last episode for this season. Last year, Tornante and Vugar were happy enough with the results of the Booth and how it was doing overseas that they triggered the option for me to write the next script. So I actually turned in the Booth 2 script 4 months ago.
Oh my gosh, that's going to be awesome.
Yeah.
And it's really fun, I have to tell you, because I'm so glad I wrote it now. Already wrote it, because I began writing it last year. I turned it in, as I said, 4 months ago, so that no one can accuse me of following the audience's lead, because the audience is on some things and wrong about other things. And I'm just enjoying the fact that I have exactly the story I would have written anyway before I found out how the show was doing. And I'm really enjoying that. And so where that is in production is a mystery to me. There are conversations going on at Vugaroo and I believe Hulu about where to go next with it. And I'll hear someday about that. In terms of other projects, I'm currently writing a feature assignment right now, a joint American-Chinese independent film that I'm very excited about. It's a fantasy. And I have written and directed, as you just mentioned, a short film called In the Eyes, which I wrote for Kate Maberly and Jack Conley, who are both actors in the Booth at the End.
Sure. Is that Jenny Ann Allen?
Yeah. And we're in post-production right now. I had written, my manager said, it's time for you to direct something so we can move you into that field, because my temperament isn't actually writer. My temperament is storyteller, and I actually just want to get as many hats as I can so that I can move as efficiently and productively forward in telling as many stories as I can. Anything I can do to take the waiting process out is something I want to work toward. And so he said, you should direct a film. You need a short film as a very expensive resume to show people you can do it. And I wrote three really bad short films, really bad. They were trying to be directory and show off directing, and they were just terrible. And eventually I said, well, wait, what do I want to see? I want to see two great actors working. I was riding my bike up the path along the Santa Monica Beach, and I immediately thought of Jack and Kate, in part because I love them both as actors so much, but also because I just thought if I put their two faces on screen together, they don't belong together, and you immediately wonder what's going on and what's going to happen. And so I came up with a short film script for that. We shot that a couple weeks ago. I worked with Brooks Geyer as my DP, who has worked with Michael Bay and Tony Scott. I had an amazing producer, Jonathan Lynch. He pulled together an amazing crew, and it's in post-production at Hybrid Edit right now. I'll be going in all day Tuesday to work with the editor. She's assembled a rough cut, and I'm very looking forward to getting that going. Yeah. And I've got a feature assignment that my manager is meeting a financier for this week. And then I've got other projects, including Eric's Heiser's short story, but I've also got projects of my own I want to be moving forward, both for the internet. And I've also written, you know, I mean, I'm in Hollywood. I've written my TV specs and my features specs, and I've got projects that I want to get out the door. So
that sounds really exciting. You know, Brandon, who is our head writer for our website, had asked us to ask you about In the Eyes. Can you give us a quick summary of what it's about?
Sure, absolutely. So it's only a 9-page short film. It begins with a guy waking up, Jack Conley. He wakes up, he makes coffee in the morning. He carries his coffee to a couch in a living room. It's still like just first thing in the morning. The sunlight is cutting through slightly parted curtains at almost a horizontal angle. And he puts the coffee mug down on a coffee table, and there's a disassembled revolver with cleaning supplies on the table. There's an old cell phone and a notepad that he picks up. He makes a call, and he's taking instructions, sort of like, so is this a threat or a threat? And we realize he's some sort of criminal guy. There's motion by the door outside, light moving underneath the doorway, and an envelope slides under the door. And he says to somebody he's talking to on the phone, did you send somebody over? And he says, okay, wait, I'll be right back. And he hangs up the phone. He picks up an automatic pistol from the couch. So it's the second gun just lying around. And he walks over to the door, you know, off the sight line of the door, going up to the edge of the door, and picks up the envelope, and there's money inside. And he opens up the door, and it's little Kate Maberly standing outside. And she's come to hire somebody to kill somebody. And she offers more money, and she gets inside, but she's really not there for that. She's there because she's looking for the man who killed her mother years ago. She thinks this is the guy. She's brought a gun, and she's got to find out if it's him.
Wow.
Yeah.
That sounds great.
Yeah, I want to hear more, but I'll wait for the films.
One of the things we wanted to ask you about is, you know, you mentioned a little bit how the show is so much about the choices we make and about our desires and what we do with them. And one of the things I'm curious about is, what sort of questions do you want the audience to be asking themselves as they're watching the show and kind of getting involved with the characters?
That's a really good question. I guess I'm afraid I'm going to blow the answer on this because I've never thought this through and I don't have anything canned. I think to me it's honestly less about what questions I want them to ask than certain habits I think that are on the table. One of the things that's become clear to me is people have arguments about the form of the storytelling, that we've thrown out cinematic language and we're just sort of trapped in this booth listening to and watching people talk. It's a show about paying attention. You know, the man keeps talking about the details and he's trying to get them to pay attention to what they're thinking or doing, and usually they don't want to be thinking about what they're doing. And so what I'm really curious about is, here's a question. Are we really paying attention to the decisions we make, to the actions we take, to the consequences of what we get for the things that we want or do receive. There was this lovely post. I was warned not to read any of the comments online, but I am thick-skinned and an idiot, so I've been reading everything. And this lovely post from a woman who wrote how angry she was. The show was making her very angry because she was really angry about this little girl who's basically this pawn between these two men's desires. You know, James and Willem. That one wants to pin up, one wants to make save his own son, and there's this girl who we don't even get to see on screen who's actually the center of their actions. She could die because of their own desires and their fight over her. And she talked about how angry she was about it, and then she said, and then I realized that there are little girls like in Iraq or Afghanistan who are getting blown up because of the fights other people are having around them, and that we're making decisions like this every day and we're not even thinking about it. Or we think about it, but we justify it. And we say, well, there's enough bad people over there so that if some little girls get killed for what we want, it's okay. And I guess what I really want us to be asking is, are we really paying attention? I don't mind if people do something selfish for their own ends to a degree, because we have to do selfish things no matter what. And I even assume that in life there will be sometimes costs to other people for us to get what we want. I think Mrs. Tyler's right in that little monologue she gave early on in the show, in the series. But it's when we do it and we don't even bother paying attention. I want people to own their decisions. Yeah. So I guess my thing is, are we really paying attention? Are we really accepting the consequences of what we do instead of just blundering around and assuming the world is fine and that we're not affecting anyone else when we do things, when we're affecting people all the time?
Yeah, exactly. You know, you'd mentioned Willem and James and their storyline. And to me, if you've seen the videos, that's kind of my... probably my favorite storyline that's going around. Do you have a favorite storyline as you're writing that to you just really stuck out and you connected with that?
I'm hesitating because somebody I was interviewed yesterday and somebody said, who's your favorite, you know, who you most like or connect with. And yeah. I see them all as portions of myself exaggerated. So I don't think there is. I have to say that, and I don't want to give anything away because things happen tomorrow. There's one character in terms of storyline. It's also tough because different beats of their stories are more interesting to me than other beats of other character stories. So that, how do I say this? At certain times, one character is a hell of a lot more interesting to me within, let's say, a 6-minute span than other characters, but then that'll shift and another character becomes really compelling later on. There's a character who does something tomorrow that, there's one character who I think is particularly, if I could be like any of them as a role model, I know who I think the most courageous character is. And that's the character I find in totality, looking across everybody from the beginning of their journey with the man in the booth to their conclusion of their story. There's one character who I think is the most courageous, and I admire that character the most. I was just thinking about this actually like a couple hours ago on the way back from a coffee shop, that this one character's journey I find really moving. And it's not the character I think everybody's paying attention to.
That's really interesting. I want to ask you, but I don't want to be spoiled. So let's wait until tomorrow.
Another listener question from somebody who wrote in. Wanted to know what happened to Simon, where we saw him in one episode and we really haven't seen him since. We've kind of heard more about him through Sister Carmel's story, but we haven't really seen him on screen since, I think, episode 2. Was that a function of the actor's availability or something planned in the writing, or how did that all shake out?
One of the weird things, and you know, I'm making up a new kind of form, so I'm like, I had to learn some lessons even in the second script, the second season. Mm-hmm. This idea that I can tell the same story from two different points of view is kind of interesting and fun, like with James and Willem. But it also means that if I'm not careful, I start losing face time with particular characters and they start dissipating from the audience's imagination. Sister Carmel was such a compelling character to me that I wanted to make sure to stick with her and not have her vanish at the expense of bringing more Simon in. It had nothing to do with the actor. again, we knew those two scenes going in. It was a very tight shoot. We just set up shop and shot it for 10 days over 2 weeks. I think it was a function of me just having to make a decision on whose voice was going to tell most of the story. And for better or for worse, and I have my own thoughts on what I would do differently if I could build a time machine now. But for better or for worse, I decided to stick with Sister Carmel. The scenes with Simon were there. There were other scenes that were cut in the development process. But in terms of just getting a script that we could actually afford to shoot and having to make decisions about what characters to keep and what scenes to keep, I decided to weight the story more toward Sister Carmel.
You know, you talked about the different actors, and what was the casting process like for this show?
Noel Bright, who's another executive whose name I have not mentioned yet, and I have to. Noel Bright was another executive at Tornante, and his wife is a casting director. And so she's the one who cast the film. The casting process actually begins like this. It's a great little story. Jessica Landau, who's our terrific director and had directed episodes of TV, was brought on. And she was at a dinner party where she met Xander Berkeley. And she had a great time talking with him. And then a few days later, she was thinking, and she ended up facing him on Facebook or something, I guess. And she was thinking, okay, so we got to cast this thing. Who the heck am I going to cast as the man? This is crazy. Like, this part is just insane. And she thought, well, what we really need is a Xander Berkeley type, because she just met him. And then she thought, well, wait, I just met him. Why don't I ask him? I mean, it's an internet show and he does TV, but maybe he'll do it. So she sends him an email, a message on Facebook, saying, I know this is kind of crazy, but please listen. It's kind of a cool script. It's for the internet. I think you'd be great for this role. Would you please read it? And he says, sure, send it over. Because what we did not know at the time is that Xander loves doing independent films and experimental work. He's a painter. He has a whole indie vibe to him. So he reads the script, and apparently the next morning at 7 a.m., there's an email already from Xander saying, yes, I will do this.
Wow.
So that's how we got awesome. Xander.
Yeah, that's great.
Off the script. And that opened up a lot of doors. Suddenly Xander Berkeley was doing it, and so other actors would show up. Like, I know that you know that Sarah Clark is Xander's. You know Sarah, the woman who plays Sister Carmel is Xander's wife.
Yeah,
right. And also his co-star in first couple seasons of 24.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so, and she was actually pregnant during the shooting of the film, by the way.
Oh, no, I didn't know that.
That's an ironic twist for her character.
Yeah.
She was either going to play Doris the waitress or Sister Carmel. I said, you know what? You choose whichever one you want to do. And she decided, because of the mode she was in, she was going to play Sister Carmel. And she was, you know, I think she's just amazing. Our whole cast is just amazing. And so she came on board because she really liked the material as well. And then other people started showing up. And Noel's wife, whose name is escaping me, and I'm ashamed for that right now. But she did an amazing job of pulling together these great actors who all showed up. The way we shot it was Xander was, of course, in the booth every day for 2 weeks. God bless him. And then each day, a new actor would show up, and we would shoot all their material consecutively in chronological order. So it was sort of like a little short story we shot. And then we would wrap that actor, and the next morning, like Christmas, a new actor would show up, and we'd do it again. It was really just a lovely experience. It was just great.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah. You know, you had mentioned Doris. So we did have kind of a fun question here from one of our fans. They had said, what is the man drinking in the diner? Doris keeps bringing him hot water, but there aren't any tea bags to be seen. Can you answer that question?
That must be a we didn't capture it right, because I can tell you there were tea bags.
Oh, okay.
He's just drinking tea.
Okay.
Well, there was a big discussion. Well, big meaning we didn't have time to have big discussions, but on our show it was the equivalent of a big discussion. What does the man drink? Is it coffee? Is it juice? And Xander said, I really think he's drinking tea. And I was like, all right, tea it is. Because in the script it's all coffee. But because it was a very David Lynch Twin Peaks moment for me to have that much coffee going on. Yeah, but we went with tea at the end.
All right. Let's see here. Looking at our questions here, you know, did you always along the whole process of writing plan on keeping it exclusively in the diner, or was there ever any idea that maybe you would take it out of the diner?
For me, there was never any question of leaving the diner. The whole premise was, part of the design premise was, making sure I made something that couldn't collapse financially in terms of production costs. I wanted to make the most compelling script I could for the most economical means possible. And that meant hanging out in a diner booth, yeah, just to make sure nothing got complicated. There were some discussions at one point of, in fact, somebody on Hulu, or several people on Hulu have suggested this, of like even just cutting away the images of things happening off screen. I think that would, in my own view, and we'll see what happens if the show moves forward and new people come on who are financing it, if they open it up, I know that's a possibility, but I think leaving the booth would be a mistake unless it was done very specifically. If we just cut away the pictures or memory images, it's almost like trying to apologize for the weirdness of the structure and paper over it, sure, rather than really saying, wait, what is this show about? For me, the action of the show is not actually what's happening off screen. People keep referring to the action off screen not being shown, and it's great. I mean, the fact that people are saying things like, I keep seeing images from the show that I realized were never shown. That's amazing to me. That's the magic trick I wanted. But if we really look at how the show is set up, the action is actually what the camera is recording. The action is the equivocation, the dodging, the assuming responsibility, the dodging responsibility, the making decisions, the waffling, the struggling with desire, the struggling with morality. That's what the show is about. That is the action. The camera is pointed exactly at what the show is about.
Yeah, it really makes the show about the choices and the consequences that follow them.
Right.
It kind of almost has a Reservoir Dogs feel when you think about it, where you see everything before and everything after, but not the actual action itself. And I think that makes it really fascinating to me.
I mean, I hope so. I mean, that was part of the design. Like, you know, can I get away with this? It's a weird show in a couple of levels, and it's definitely weird in the how we chose to tell the story level, or how I chose to tell the story. There's a sense of, you're right. I mean, we're not going to talk about the bank robbery. We're only dealing with things inside and outside. And I went even deeper into that. I would say Tarantino actually was an influence on this as well, in the sense that he trusts dialogue, he trusts actors. He knows how to get a lot of mileage out of the simplest things because he really does love actors. And I really love actors. Again, going back to If Everybody's Building Giant Robots movies, make a movie about a mouse. I remember years ago thinking of the phrase, the special effect of the actor's face. And I'd love to make a big movie. I've written, you know, some specs that are crazy big. And ultimately, though, if it comes down to it, as long as I can keep making content, I have no qualms with hanging it on actors I love to get the story told.
All right. Let's see. You know, it sounds like you had a chance to be on set there as they were shooting, and we had actually gotten an email from the director just thanking us for some of our reviews. So I know that there was also a director there. How much direction did the actors get? You know, especially, you know, Xander Berkeley, who plays the man with a lot of subtlety. Did you guys, was that natural for him, or did you guys kind of direct him to play the character in that way?
Well, first of all, I didn't direct the actors at all. That would be Jessica. And I would say that Xander, when Xander and I first spoke on the phone, he called me to talk about the material and to thank me for the script. And he said, I feel like I've been preparing to play this part all of my life. So he, you know, like he had it down out of the gate. I remember I got a call from Josh Rimes. This was after Jessica sent Xander the script and he'd said he wanted to do it. I didn't know about any of this yet. I've been a fan of Xander's for years, and I get a call from Josh Rimes at Tornante, and he says, so CK, we're looking at casting, and we're thinking about, I just wanted to hear what you thought about this, we're thinking about, for the man, Xander Berkeley. And I say, oh, now you're screwed, because I'm a huge fan of his. He's perfect for the part. In fact, if you don't get him, we have failed. So you better do this or the show is not going to work. And I actually opened up the computer and I began reworking some lines of dialogue for the man to make it more of Xander's voice, because I knew Xander's sense of intelligence, judging, and mystery that you can see in all of the work he brings to bear would be perfect for this role. So he just, you know, he found his way through it. He is now the creator of that character to the degree that he shaped how the man does so many things while sitting in that booth.
Yeah, it's a phenomenal performance, and hopefully get some recognition for it going forward.
I hope so. Again, this recognition thing is, I've had, like, I'm not saying I would make a deal with the man. I was, but I've been watching my behavior and not particularly happy with some impatience that's come into my heart, and realizing that I had to just slow it down and say, well, this is where we are. We're maybe the show that begins breaking that open. But when you look at people like Xander and Jenny Blong and Sarah Clark and Jack Conley and Kate and Jenny and all these Matt and these just amazing actors playing these parts. I mean, the woman who played Mrs. Tyler, I remember being on the set that day. That might have been the third or fourth day, and being astounded that there was this wonderful little old lady sitting there talking about building a bomb.
Yeah, it's great. It's a great juxtaposition for her character to have her doing that.
Who the hell agreed with this? Like, this is the weirdest show in the world. Because it's one thing to write it. It's another thing to be standing 5 feet away and watching somebody say the words out loud and her doing it so effectively. We have these amazing performances in a show that trusted itself to stay simple and on point, not overcomplicate. We had producers and executives who backed the material. John Radulovich and his partner Lou showed up from Californication and pulled together the team. It's just amazing to me. The thing that got to me was on the shoot was each day on Christmas morning, each Christmas morning when the new actor showed up, they'd come up to me and say, thank you so much for this material. They were just so happy with the material. And I got to tell you, that made me the happiest guy in the world. And then it was on the fourth day, I watched the camera crew, all our operators, standing outside the gate to Cadillac Jack's, 15 minutes, it was 7:45 in the morning. We can't even get in till 8 o'clock. They're standing around the gate waiting to get in, talking about the setup coming up, because they can't wait to get to work on this thing. Because everybody got invested in doing the best work they can. That mission statement I came up with, I sent to my AD for the short film just to try to make clear what I wanted the short film set to run like. I said, look, here are my three things. I want to make stories that people don't see coming down the road. I want to build environments where everybody gets to work at the top of their craft in ways they would not have assumed or guessed they could have, and find out new ways of doing their job and challenge themselves. And I want to keep people employed. Those are my three points. And if I do that, I think I'm doing the best work you can possibly do as a storyteller in this town. And that's what I want to keep working on. And that came from the booth experience. Everyone was so engaged, I got spoiled. I know a lot of shoots aren't like that. And that's too bad, because I've got to now make every shoot like that. I never want to be on a shoot that is not like that.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, we just have one last question here. And I think you'd already hit on this, but, you know, you tapped into thematically rich idea of these moral dilemmas. So to you, what is it about moral dilemmas that makes the show, not just this show, but all shows and all stories, so intriguing?
Well, my friend, it is my belief that these moral dilemmas are what storytelling is about. How do I approach this? This is like a whole class. Stories are about the choices the characters make. We don't often see them that way. This show, because I basically wanted to build something that was production-wise simple enough and not depend on cinematic language or spectacle, I basically took all the water of other cinematic storytelling out and we're left with a dry powder of dramatic narrative, which is the choices we make. So it's very blunt and clear on the screen. But if we look at, let's say, Aliens, which is a movie I love, just off the top of my head, Ripley begins as a character who is told that bad things are happening out there and she might be able to help. And God bless her, she does not want to go help. She already dealt with the monster. Thank you very much. She's had her fill. And then each step of the way through the movie, she chooses to invest more and more of her presence into the conflict until she ends up fighting the alien queen one-on-one over a child she only met 24 hours earlier, which at the beginning of the movie, she never would have thought she would be capable of doing. All she wanted to do was get back to work and sleep and have a good night's sleep. So every story, if Jack and the Beanstalk, it's like, do I make the deal with the man that's going to disappoint my mother or not? Do I help the little gray man in the woods by offering him some of my food when he asks for food? Am I going to be kind to my stepsister or not? I mean, all stories are about the social dynamics of how we treat each other, and dramatic narrative most of all, because dramatic narrative ultimately is about how characters interact with each other. And if there's not a moral component to that, there's really nothing particularly interesting going on. If there is a moral component, no matter how much it's gussied up, then there's something interesting going on, because that's at the point where we turn as a society to our stories to inform us about how we want to behave, how life is complicated and we're not sure how to behave, how one kind of behavior is sometimes good in some circumstances but bad in other circumstances. All these things are what storytelling is about. So I think that without a moral dimension of storytelling, we don't know what we have. If you look at The Godfather and Michael's decisions through that movie, if you look at a romantic comedy, it's all going to be about how do I choose who I'm going to spend my life with. I understand that there's romance and all those other things, but ultimately the characters are looking for somebody they want to partner up with and trust with their children, you know, in a very ultimate way. If you look at Titanic, Rose is trying to figure out who the father for the child that isn't even conceived yet is going to be. She's got two men in front of her, and one of them's going to end up being a dad, and she's got to decide how she's going to do it. And we know how she makes her decision. It's the character of the men is how she's going to make that decision. That's moral behavior. And those are choices made along moral behavior. So it's interesting. I'm working on this feature assignment, and I only last night, I've been sweating this thing out for 3 months now, and I've got a lot of images and thought about a lot of plots. But it was only yesterday when I saw what the moral question for my main character to go through was that the whole thing began finally falling into place. I don't know how to work otherwise, because if not, it's just sound and fury and plot. And plot is not particularly interesting to me. I'm thankful that you guys are so dedicated to trying to figure out who's going to live and die and how things are going to turn out. Yeah. And I'm like, yeah, that's not the part I care about most, though. What I care about is it's not whether Randall Wallace lives or dies at the end of Braveheart. It's the choices he made up until the moment he lives or dies. That's what I really care about.
That is incredibly well put on the importance of story and why stories matter and why humans have been telling each other these things for, you know, hundreds of thousands of years. And
it's like a moral hygiene. It's like our soap. We scrub each other with stories and we say, I think I get a cleaner idea now. And again, sometimes they're very didactic. And it's like, behave this way. And those stories usually are very boring to me. It's stories that talk about the complexity of life and how hard life is. One of the reasons I think I can respond to all my characters is because, again, they're exaggerated qualities of myself, but I love them all because I get their problems and how they wish life was different. And it is hard to be alive as a human being. We have imaginations that can dream of paradise on earth. We all could, if we just sat down for 5 minutes, go, if only my life were like this, it'd be perfect. And then we also have bodies that are finite and damaged or diseased or aging in circumstances which are confined by resources or obligations that distract us from what we would be our paradise. So we dream of the infinite perfect world, and we are also in a very finite world at the same time. I don't know how that tension does not drive us crazy every day. And I think that's one of the main themes or notions that the main grains of sand that I grew the pearl, if it is one, out of the booth. This tension between what we want and what it actually life is, I think, nightmarish in many ways. And all of my characters are going through that tension.
Well, CK, we just want to thank you again, not only for being on the show with us today, but for making the booth at the end just this fantastic bit of programming out there. We've absolutely enjoyed it, recommending it to everyone we talk to. And we just want to wish you tons of success, not only with this show, but with your future projects going forward. And it's been an absolute blast talking to you today.
Thank you so much, guys. And I have to thank you as well. Your comments and commentary and outreach to other people, not only does it help the show, but making things as hard. I already told the story, like the two projects that died before I got to the booth. Getting things up and made, that I met for coffee with the guys who produced The Ring and The Ring 2, and Neil Edelstein shook my hand before we said anything, said, "Congratulations on the booth. You got something made."
Yeah.
And so getting things made is hard in Hollywood, and to get a response from people is really, really gratifying. It means a lot to have your enthusiasm and passion for the project. And so I have to thank you as well, because we don't have money for billboards and buses. We can only go by word of mouth and the internet for most of our audience. And you guys are helping to make that happen. So I'm very grateful to the both of you and everyone on your team. So thank you very much.
You're more than welcome.
All right, man.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Take care.
Yeah, you too.
It's a trap.
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 It's a trap. It's a trap.
All right, Ben, we're back.
We are back.
And we are ready for some listener feedback. So we got quite a bit of listener feedback, huh?
We do. And we're not going to be able to get to all of it tonight. So there's a few things that we're going to have to wait on for next week.
So if you called in or if you wrote in and you don't hear it this week, check back next week.
But one of the things we do have to get to is that last week we had the conclusion of our contest to name our mascot.
Yes, and Doug has won, and Doug has called in.
Yes, with an acceptance speech that I have not listened to yet.
Oh my gosh, so this is going live. I mean, if we have to censor it,
yeah,
this is going to be horrible.
Doug, let's hope you kept the F-bombs to a minimum here.
All right, let's hear it.
All right.
Ben, Matt, this is Doug in Atlanta, and I am so honored that you chose my suggestion, Theo, as the name for your new mascot. I can't tell you how much this means to me. Really, I'm sure it means something, but I just can't say what it would be. I'd like to thank a few people who were instrumental in my life. Mrs. Hutchinson, my 8th grade math teacher, Professor Toll, my college computer science teacher, and A1 Plumbing for having pumped my septic tank last July. More relevant to this current honor, I'd like to thank all those TV shows and movies with funny gray aliens in them, without which this particular mascot might not have been drawn, and thus I would not have had the opportunity to name him. I thankfully accept this new position, mascot namer for the Sci-Fi Christian Podcast, otherwise known as the MNFTSFCP, and I will wear this new moniker proudly. Except, perhaps, when I'm out with family or something, some folks do get embarrassed easily. Once again, thank you so much for bestowing this honor upon me and for the royalty checks to follow. For this, I am truly humbled.
Wow, that's the best acceptance speech
phenomenal
that we've ever received.
Doug, well done.
Well done,
Doug. That was hysterical. And the checks are in the mail.
I am so glad that we chose Doug.
Yeah, that was great.
Well, chose Theo, I should say, which is the name of our mascot. And he had mentioned gray aliens, and we're not really sure what color Theo actually is, because he appears...
He's kind of blue.
Well, he appears in lots of different logos.
He does.
Sometimes red, sometimes green, sometimes blue.
Yeah.
So that is a mystery that will be determined at a later date.
Theo is harmonizing different ethnicities in the Sci-Fi Christian.
Different alien ethnicities.
Yeah, blue ones, green ones, red ones.
Perhaps more in the future.
Maybe yellow someday.
perhaps.
All sorts of stuff.
You got an email there?
I do have an email from one of our coolest listeners out there, Blondine, who is a homeschooling mother of 10.
That's right. She wrote it in not that long ago, didn't
yeah,
she?
Yeah, so she has some interesting stuff to say. First, she says, for the potential loss segment intro music, which we'll talk more about in just a second.
Oh, yeah. This is Wayne's plan to help me talk more about Lost.
Yeah, not going to happen. How about the theme music of the show? Didn't it sound kind of like a creaking gate, not really like music? I love the originality of the Lost music creators with that unhummable piece of sound.
Wait, I can hum it.
Okay. Yeah, kind of like that. Yeah. And then we get to
you really did sound like a cat there, like a dying cat.
A little bit. And then I get to my favorite part of the email where she says, also, though I do respect Matt, that's always a great way to begin.
Oh boy, this is not good.
I think Ben has a humorous thread going about his reading habits. Ben, I beseech you to record and occasionally play the bit of episode 26 where Matt says he opened a book, which you later revealed was 300 pages long, and said something like, I saw that it had so many words and figured I don't have time for this now.
I said that?
Apparently you did.
Great. That's not good.
Blondine, thanks for writing in. It is always great to hear from you, and thanks for listening. Glad to have you as one of our favorite fans here on the Sci-Fi Christian.
Thank you, Blondine, for nothing.
Now, speaking of the Lost segment, Matt.
Just kidding, Blondine. Yes, the Lost segment that is forthcoming.
We actually had a call in this week specifically about this.
So people are really excited about this Lost segment.
Well, maybe excited is a bit too strong of a word. Let's just listen to this and... we'll see what we think.
Okay.
Hey, Matt and Ben, John Wilkerson here again, and I just have to call in after hearing Wayne Henderson's voicemail about there being a Lost segment in the podcast. Ben, I am with you. If I never, ever, ever hear another word about the TV show Lost, I would feel wonderful. I don't understand people's fascination with this show. The show has been over for years, okay? Because, you know, everyone's going to say, well, you know, they just had the thing and they went back to the island and so it hasn't been over that long. That show was over years ago, okay? These guys had their heads in the sand. They were lost while they were writing it. I don't understand. I don't get it. Please don't talk about Lost. I think there needs to be a fee that needs to be charged. Every time Matt talks about Lost, he needs to sit down and read 10 pages out of one of the dozens of books that he's supposed to be reading right there on the show out loud. That's it. Bye. Sorry I sound so angry because I'm tired of hearing about Lost.
Well, wait, let me take this back.
That's one of our best calls ever, I think.
Let me take this back.
I think John made some great points.
John, I'm sure you're a nice guy. But come on, Lost. All right, first of all, let me take this one step at a time. First of all, Lost is, if not the greatest, one of the greatest television shows of all time. If you're a first-time listener, this is my favorite show, which I talk about often on the Sci-Fi Christian.
Some might say too often.
I think John would say that. Okay, secondly, writers did not have their head in the sand while writing. They had a plan, a five-year plan, which, because of the writer's strike and shortened seasons, got turned into a six-year plan.
That excuse only works so far.
No, it completely works. They had a plan. They knew exactly what each season would entail. So, to conclude, you're wrong. They knew what they were doing. And, you know, sure, there were times that maybe they didn't know every single thing that was going to happen, but they knew where the show was going from start to finish.
Now, my take on Lost is I like it more than John did. I think the character work is great. I think it did a pretty poor job of answering a lot of mysteries.
Here's the thing, Ben. I know that on the show you have to pretend like you don't like Lost, but
no,
you and
Lost.
I watched it until the very end together.
In fact,
me and you might not even be friends if it wasn't for Lost.
So yeah,
we first started talking.
Here's all I'm saying.
If the fans don't know this, me and Ben first started talking because we shared an interest in Lost and we went to the same church.
Absolutely.
And so our first conversation over some Lian Chin was?
About you leading a small group at church.
And?
Lost.
Okay, there it is. So to conclude, Lost, a great show agreed upon by both Ben and myself. Thus,
whoa, don't you lump me together with your opinion here.
No, I mean, you agree. This is the thing. The only thing you didn't like about it was you didn't feel like it answered all of your questions.
But, which was a pretty significant part of the show.
Sure, some things were left unsaid, but it didn't make everything else we saw less good.
All I'm saying is that Lost is a good show, nowhere near good enough to warrant a weekly segment after it's been off the air for over a year. I can think of a lot of shows I like more.
Maybe a bi-weekly segment.
Like Battlestar is a better show, Firefly is a better show, Buffy is a better show.
I like two of the shows you just said. I haven't watched Buffy enough to make a decision on that.
Yeah.
But,
I mean, I can keep going. There's so many shows that are strong.
Name a few more and I'll see if I disagree.
Well, I don't know if you've seen them all. Like, do they have to be genre fiction shows?
Well, I know you like Everybody Loves Raymond.
You think? I've seen it once.
Okay.
Like, Game of Thrones is a better show.
That's a pretty good show.
Lost. To go outside genre fiction, I'm watching Deadwood right now. Ooh. Also on HBO.
You think Deadwood is better than Lost?
Oh my gosh, yes.
I've never seen Deadwood, so I can't really.
How do you think that?
I'm just surprised because I didn't know you thought that.
Oh yeah, it's fantastic.
So I like Battlestar.
Carnival is a better show.
Are you kidding me?
No.
You really think all those shows are better than Lost?
Yes.
I'm shocked. I mean,
Lost is really good.
Battlestar and Firefly, awesome.
I'd probably list Lost in my top 10 shows, but it'd be near the bottom of that list.
Oh my gosh.
Now, Lost is a better show than shows like Fringe. It's a better show than The X-Files. It's a better show than The 4400, which I really enjoyed. So it's a good show, but the greatest show of all time? No, not even close.
To me, the greatest show of all time.
Better than even something like Battlestar?
Yeah, I mean, I think Battlestar is my number two or three. I like Firefly in two or three. I can't pick between those two.
Yeah.
You're starting to see the shape of my top five.
But don't worry, John. Don't worry. We will not be having the Lost segment, but I do love your idea.
I'm sorry, of
Matt reading 10 pages out of one of his books every time he mentions Lost.
Sorry, Wayne. It sounds like the Lost segment's not going to happen.
All right, Matt. Well, I think that's it for listener feedback tonight. We had a few more things that we'll get to next time.
But, all right. Yeah,
we're going to wrap things up here.
This has been a great episode. So thank you for tuning in if this is your first time. And thanks for coming in to listen to this.
Yeah, thank you, CK, again for being on the show. We loved having you.
Exactly. So, everybody, that's all from here. I'm Matt Anderson.
And I am Ben DiBono.
We're the Sci-Fi Christians, signing off.